To all who come to this nerdy place, welcome. The George Sanders Show is your show. Each week we are going to be talking about two movies, one old, one newer. This week we will be discussing Fritz Lang's The Big Heat and also Johnny To's recent film Drug War. To my right in this lovely Snoopy-filled kitchen is the Dave Foley to my Kevin McDonald, Sean Gilman. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Mike.
Sean and I have known each other for almost 10 years now. We started our capers at the Metro Cinema, now defunct, in the University District of Seattle. And I think Sean and I spent 5 years arguing with each other at the Usher stand about movies and music and everything in between. And when the Metro closed, Sean and I had nothing better to do, so we've ended up here talking into a computer. But while we were at the Metro, Sean and I ran a repertory series for how long?
5 years.
5 years. It was called Metro Classics. We ran a whole bunch of really awesome movies. We had some interesting experiences. What was your favorite Metro Classics experience?
Probably selling out Gone with the Wind, just actually seeing 150 old people in one very hot, very smelly place was pretty exciting.
Some rat-infested hovel. Yeah, that was pretty good. I think The Red Shoes was probably my favorite, because it was a similar experience, and I think it was the first time that we had something like... Oh no, Casablanca was really big too, but it was a big deal. That was a lot of fun. But anyway, so here we are now. We've been kicked out of the movie theater, and we've been sent to the hinterlands, and we're now talking in Sean's kitchen. So yeah, without further ado, I guess we will get to our first film, The Big Heat.
I'll have your badge and gun now.
You can have it permanently.
One moment. I asked for your gun, too.
That doesn't belong to the department. It's mine. Bought and paid for.
I'm warning you officially. Don't try to use it.
I won't. Not until I catch up with the people who murdered my wife.
That was a clip from The Big Heat. That was Glenn Ford being totally badass. And I feel like that's... You know, when I find the men that killed my wife, or whatever he says, that kind of launched 1,000 film trailers, it feels like, after that. But The Big Heat, yeah, Fritz Lang, this is kind of sad to say. I've only seen a few Fritz Lang films. I've seen the big ones, you know, M and Metropolis, and actually Metro Classics ran Testament of Dr. Mabuse, which was... Well, also one of my highlights of the 5 years that we did that. It's a great, great film. But The Big Heat was new to me, and it was awesome. I have no qualms. I have nothing to nitpick with that film. I mean, it was just, it starts literally with a bang, a suicide. And you know what I really liked in the beginning? I shouldn't talk about expectation, because everybody comes into things differently and stuff, but... I think because I had recently skimmed, read's not the word, but I skimmed David Bordwell's thing on Mildred Pierce. He posted a couple of days ago. And for some reason, Mildred Pierce is in my head. And so when The Big Heat started, I was expecting, after he shoots himself in the head and falls down on the desk, I expected the film to then do a flashback thing where it would kind of, you know, give you... how it came to this, and I was really kind of cringing expecting that, because I don't really care for that narrative conceit, and that kind of happens a lot from my experience, especially in film noir.
Yeah, it's definitely a noir convention to have a kind of flashback structure or a story that loops back on itself. But that's, you know, and not doing that is one of many ways that The Big Heat is atypical for film noir. The most obvious is that it has a happy ending, and the hero is a good guy. He's a family man who doesn't really do anything immoral, But I guess we should kind of get into what he does do and the plot of the film. He's Glenn Ford plays a detective investigating this suicide of a cop who had been taking money from the mob.
He was on the take.
He was on the take. And with his suicide, he's left a letter that that spills the beans about the criminal syndicate that runs the country, or the city. And his wife, instead of turning in said letter, decides to call the syndicate and blackmail them for it.
Yeah, and what another thing I liked about the film is that these details that we can sum up in a sentence, like you just did, are teased out, you know, throughout the first, I mean, throughout the movie itself, you know, it's not, you don't know why when she comes down the stairs she's not distraught, you don't know, you know, what her plan really is, and it's kind of, you know, Lang gives you enough as you're going to follow along, but you don't really piece that all together until later in the film, and I think that's another great choice.
Ford, being a upright, moral detective, refuses to back down in his investigation of the case, and he keeps after it despite repeated warnings from his superiors and other criminals, because he's kind of Serpico-like. He sees himself as the one just cop in the city, and it ends up getting his wife blown up.
Yeah, in a surprisingly, well, surprisingly shocking is redundant, but it's a brutal movie. I mean, it's you know, with the opening suicide and then this just giant explosion, and it's shown off screen, but then you see the aftermath as he pulls his wife's body from the wreckage. It's a slap in the face. I mean, it really gets your attention.
It's definitely a shock because, you know, the wives don't blow up in Hollywood movies in the 1950s. It's not an expected thing. Especially, you know, Glenn Ford has this, he's not kind of a tortured soul like a Robert Mitchum or Robert Ryan or even Humphrey Bogart. You know, more typical noir heroes. He's like the family guy. He's like the Courtship of Eddie's Father or Blackboard Jungle. He's just kind of this upright symbol of 50s masculinity.
And Lang does, one of my favorite things about this movie is, and it's something that you wouldn't, going into it, you wouldn't expect this to be one of the highlights of the film, but the portrayal of that marriage is so well done in just the couple of scenes they have together. You know, they have that scene at the dinner table and they're sharing each other's, you know, beer and cigarettes and
a very large steak
and humongous medium rare steak. But you just really, you just grasp the goodness in this couple and they seem to genuinely like each other and it's done very, very well. And that's what makes the explosion and death and Ford's subsequent, you know, ice cold approach to everything, it totally makes that real.
Yeah, after he dies, as we heard in the sound clip, he turns in his badge and keeps his gun and goes off on his own to find the killers and track them down. And in doing so, he gets the help of Gloria Graham,
who is awesome.
Who plays the girlfriend of Lee Marvin, who is the head henchman for the syndicate. And Gloria Graham is fascinated by Glenn Ford because he's so moral, and she's not really used to that. So she goes along and kind of hangs around him, which gets her in trouble with Lee Marvin and gets her a face full of coffee in the film's most famous and most shocking scene.
Yeah, that is, well, going back to what you were saying about, you know, the wife dying is not an expected thing in a noir or, in a film. Also, having the female lead be disfigured for half of the film, you know, she's, after the coffee, you know, Gloria Graham's wearing a bandage on half of her face. And then And the reveal of her actual scarred face at the end is incredibly powerful and really, I mean, brave for her to do that role and, you know, for Lang to show the effects of that brutal, violent scene.
I've seen this film several times before, and watching it again the other night, I was shocked to see that we don't actually see the coffee splash in her face. It's one mm-hmm. of those things where I remembered it being much more explicit than it actually was, kind of like the ear scene in Reservoir Dogs. Like mm-hmm. people remember seeing the ear get cut off, even though it right. happens off screen. And Lang here focuses on the coils and the burner that the coffee pot is sitting on, and that's what we see as Marvin splashes her in the face.
And then it cuts rapidly to the guys playing poker in the other room, you know, and their reaction to her scream as yeah. he throws that coffee. And let me just say out there, as a little tip for anybody that's looking to get into a relationship, don't date Lee Marvin, because it's not going to end well. In this movie.
Yeah, generally Lee Marvin not a...
I mean, Lee Marvin's awesome, don't get me wrong.
Lee Marvin as a person, I'm sure. I'm sure a Lee wonderful Marvin, husband and
sure.
father.
Don't date Lee Marvin, the fictional Lee Marvin, yeah. who also, you know, I really need to praise because he, you know, this is a cliche to say, but they don't make them like that anymore, you know? I mean, there's nobody out there that's doing the type of stuff Lee Marvin does in this or in any of the movies that he's in. I mean, he's such a singular presence, and that voice of his is just so, you know, overpowering.
If I had to pick a modern Lee Marvin, I might say, like, Michael Shannon. But he's much bigger.
Shannon's,
he's a more imposing presence. Lee Marvin, it's all, like, attitude.
Well, and Lee Marvin, I don't know how I should phrase this. I mean, Michael Shannon goes over the top a little bit. I mean, Lee Marvin does too a little bit, but I don't know. Lee Marvin's characters seem so much more lived in, and they seem so... just, I mean, you know, when I say don't date Lee Marvin, it's because it feels like there's, you know, a big portion of these characters are kind of Lee Marvin in a way, because he was this hard-drinking, you know, dude, you know. And Michael Shannon's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you see Premium Rush?
No.
It's good.
Okay.
It's
I've heard that.
It's pretty darn good. I saw it at the drive-in. It was
awesome. I think it's by the screenwriter of Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. So.
And one of the Spider-Mans, or a couple of Spider-Mans, and Jurassic Park, which is an awesome movie. I'm just saying. But anyway, back to the big heat.
We've digressed.
Yeah, we have. Did you have more to say about the plot, or did you?
So I was talking about Gloria Graham, and she eventually gets her revenge on Lee Marvin by actually throwing coffee in his face, and we actually see that, and it's her that kind of brings resolution to the plot, which gets to what I think is a really interesting thing about the movie, and it's that the men in this film really don't do anything. All of the major actions in the plot involve women. Initially, it's the widow's decision to blackmail the syndicate that sends the whole plot in motion. It's the death of the wife that sends Glenn Ford on his quest, and then it's Gloria Graham that, by killing the widow, exposing the syndicate, solves the case. Glenn Ford, Lee Marvin, the head boss, Mike Lagana.
Mm-hmm. Which is a great name. I just like hearing them say Lagana over and over again.
They have, like, their flunkies that they will, like, send out. Like, Lee Marvin sends this guy, Larry, to kill the wife, and Larry botches the job.
Yeah, Larry's a doofus.
And Glenn Ford, in much the same way, enlists Gloria Graham to kill the widow, unwittingly, more or less, but in telling Gloria Graham that if the widow dies, then mm-hmm. everything will be solved, he sends her out to do that. So the men, the figures with actual power in society, don't directly wield that power. Instead, They well, work through other means.
Well, and even a smaller bit character, the elderly woman that works at the car dealership is, you know, she's the only person, if I remember correctly, she's the only person that actually gives Glenn Ford any, you know, meaningful information for him to track down.
She IDs Larry.
Yeah, she IDs Larry. Everybody else is tight-lipped for one reason or another. And it's an interesting thing, too, because all the men, you know, the cops and the guy that runs the auto body shop or the whatever car dealership, you know, they're all protecting themselves. You know, they all say, I've got a family, I've got, you know, wife and
their
kids.
Own financial interests.
Yeah, they're looking out for number one, and that's it. You know, and these other people who the women of the film, you know, are the one. Yeah, they really stick their neck out. You know, and that woman comes back, the elderly woman, and she positively IDs him at his apartment later. And she has no reason to do that, really. You know, but out of the goodness of her heart, and it's yeah.
So yeah, I think this is a prime example of two recurring motifs in Fritz Lang movies, and the first is just kind of puppet master figures controlling things behind the scene and creating just kind of this web of cause and effect that his movies are basically machines. Everything fits together like clockwork, and once the initial incident starts, basically how the machine plays out will be inevitable. It's just this clockwork plot structure. Like once the guy shoots himself in the head at the beginning, all of these various threads, the letter, the widow, the cop getting involved, all of them proceed inevitably from that initial premise. And it's that kind of airless structure that is so distinctive in Fritz Lang, and it makes his movies really kind of paranoid, and it also makes them really hard, for me at least, to really love. Like, I admire Fritz Lang movies, but there's something so like cold and airless about them that I find it hard to really get close to. I've seen, you know, maybe around 20 Fritz Lang movies, and I have a hard time picking my favorite. I go with The Big Heat as my favorite because, you know, it's more out of admiration than out of love.
That's interesting, because I agree. I mean, I don't think of Lang when I'm describing, you know, my favorite directors or what have you. But when I went into Letterboxd to review this after watching it, I realized that every Fritz Lang movie I've seen, I've given 5 stars to without question. I mean, you know, M is just phenomenal, and it's just a singular film, and I have maybe a rational love for Testament of Dr. Mabuza, which I've seen numerous times and I think is just phenomenal. But you're right. I wouldn't put him up in the highest of ranks because it's missing, I guess, a little something, a little
warmth.
Yeah. But you know, what's funny is, you know, that kind of thing is thrown out at the Coen brothers too, and particularly with The Man Who Wasn't There, which, as you well know, is one of my favorite films of theirs, maybe my favorite film of theirs, that a lot of people deride because they feel it's too cold and too calculated and separate from its characters.
Well, I think you see a strong influence of Lang's American noirs on The Man Who mm-hmm. Wasn't There.
Which is... God, I love that movie so much. So I guess maybe I'm a robot or something, because those things don't really affect me, the fact that there's not this, you know, this warmth to it. I everything else that is so good about Lang's movies and, you know, Coen's stuff too, is more than enough to get me through. And I find just endless fascination with their stuff.
No, I agree. Many a Lang movie on my Letterboxd list is 5 stars. But you know, when you're talking about like the greatest directors of all time, which Fritz Lang most certainly is, you know, give me a Howard Hawks or a John Ford or a Yasujiro Ozu over Lang.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, Howard Hawks, you know, I've decided, you know, he's been my go-to answer for favorite director of all time. And yeah, you know, because there is that, I just rewatched Rio Bravo, and, you know, there is that camaraderie, and there's, you know, there's a humanity to it that's yeah, it's missing from Lang stuff. But, you know, one of my favorite comedians, screen comedians, is Buster Keaton, and he's very, very, they call him Stone.
He's
the great Stone Face, but, you know, he doesn't have the warmth of Charlie Chaplin, but...
He doesn't have the sentimentality of Charlie Chaplin, but I never thought that Buster Keaton was impersonal. Lang is impersonal to me, in the sense that his movies are so machine-like and structured. I mean, I think they clearly reflect something about his personality.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, he's an auteur, he's German. A personal filmmaker.
It's German, Sean. It's called German. My girlfriend's gonna hate it. She hears that. I know what you're saying, and I agree with you, but he's also still totally awesome.
Agreed.
Okay, we're agreed.
To conclude, if like Mike, you're not that familiar with Fritz Lang's American noirs, I can't recommend highly enough his pair of films with Edward G. Robinson, Scarlet Street and Woman in the Window, from 1944-45.
They're on my watch list.
Those are must-sees. And also While the City Sleeps, which I believe stars one George Sanders. Is also pretty good.
Oh, who's he? Okay, welcome back to the George Sanders Show. You just heard Sloppy from Devo. And this is a film podcast, but I, as a drummer and a passionate fan of Devo, it would be remiss if I didn't bring up the death this week of Alan Myers, who was the drummer for Devo during their creative peak. He was in the band for about 10 years in the late 70s into the early 80s. And Myers, he was called the human metronome, which is a, you know, nice turn of phrase, but he was... one of the most sly and intelligent drummers that I've ever heard, and he's one of my biggest influences, and it's a real shame that he passed, especially so young. But you should go back, if you're not a Devo fan or whatever, you should go back and get their first two studio albums, Are We Not Men and Duty Now for the Future, because Alan's work on there is just mind-bogglingly awesome. And we'll be playing Devo throughout the show today in memory of Alan Myers.
In other sad news this week, today is the first day that Seattle will not have an Egyptian theater in several decades, as it closed. Last night was its last night. And we both, Mike and I, worked for Landmark for a number of years, and the last 3 years have seen the Neptune close, the Metro be purchased by Sundance, and now the Egyptian close. And yeah, it's really just kind of a tragic thing, both for our friends who are employed at all of those places. I was at the Neptune when it closed, and
you jumped ship from the Metro shortly before they...
I retired from the Metro just a few months before it was became under new management. And so, yeah, it's just a big loss for the Seattle film community.
What's your favorite Egyptian memory? Do you have an Egyptian...
Oh, God, I'm not sure. I saw a lot of great movies there. I saw Kurosawa's Ron there. I really was glad I got to see... got to go there one last time just a few weeks ago. We saw Drug War there in a packed auditorium, and it was nice. It was a good way to close the theater.
Yeah, I have some really good Egyptian memories. I think this isn't probably the best memory because it was full of terror. But I worked there for a free TCM sponsored screening of The Birds, where they had Robert Osborne and Tippi Hedren there doing a Q&A beforehand, and I was tasked with putting Tippi's microphone on her sweater, because the grumpy old projectionist who was supposed to do it chickened out at the last minute. And it was a packed house. They had the balcony, you know, full to the brim. We were turning people away. And there was the Q&A beforehand. And it wasn't my fault, I swear, but Tippi's mic was not loud. I mean, you couldn't hear her in the theater. Robert Osborne had his booming voice, and he was asking her these questions about working with Hitchcock and all this stuff. And she would respond, and it would just be a whisper, and maybe the first few rows could hear it. And I was manning the PA system at the foot of the stage, and I would try and bring the sound up, and it would feed back, and it would just be this shrill, shrieking thing. And so it was just this terrible, terrible scene. You know, someone shouted from the rafters, you know, "Speak up," you know, and there was someone... I assume was with TCM, who had a handheld mic that they also chickened out and were afraid to walk onto stage and give it to Tippi Hedren. So basically Robert Osborne interviewed a pantomiming Tippi Hedren for 15 minutes. And then, but it all worked out in the end, because we got to watch this great print of The Birds. And since it was sold out, I had to sit in the front row of the Egyptian with my head tilted back watching The Birds. But it was a pretty glorious...
Do you remember the first movie you saw at the Egyptian?
I think I do. I think I saw The Science of Sleep, Michel Gondry's Science of Sleep, in 2000. Was that 2006?
Yeah, something like that. 2005.
Yeah, I moved here at end of 2000. I mean, there may have been something before that, but that might be the one. The
first movie I saw there was the Adrian Lin's version of Lolita with Jeremy Irons.
Pervert.
In 1998.
Yeah.
It was not a particularly good movie, and it was not a very full auditorium.
Yeah, Signs of Sleep was pretty dead too, and that's all I'll say about that. And then finally, I mean, this news segment, I hope in the future episodes of this podcast, it's not going to be just...
horribly depressing.
Yeah, just bummer central. But there's one more death that we would like to talk about this week.
Hong Kong director Lau Kar-Wong died after fighting leukemia for 20 years. He was 76 years old. You could make a convincing case that the golden age of the Kung Fu film started in 1967 and lasted until around 1994. In 1967, with The One-Armed Swordsman, directed by Chang Che, the action direction was by Lau Kar-Wong. The genre's high point, in my opinion, its most classically perfect film, is 1978's The 36th Chamber of Shaolin, which Lau directed and starred his adopted brother, Gordon Liu, who American audiences probably know best from the Kill Bill movies. He plays the Kung Fu master
in
Kill Bill Volume 2. And then the golden age came to an end in 1994, and the standout movie that year was Drunken Master 2, which Lau directed along with Jackie Chan. And so... He was kind of the definition of the martial arts movie in its greatest era. His movies were noted for their, you know, realistic style and kind of traditional techniques. He would have opening credit sequences where his main star, Gordon Liu, would perform all of the various movements that you would then see acted out in the plot of the film, over like a red screen or something, and just kind of highlighting the performative aspect of martial arts movies. And, you know, his framing and his cutting of action is as good as anyone in the history of cinema. So
go check out some stuff.
Go check out those three movies. And if you want to, and Lau, in addition to being a great director, was also a terrific performer. He stars in his own 1979 film, Mad Monkey Kung Fu, where he does some great, some monkey style, is pretty funny.
I'm a big fan of monkey style.
He has a terrific cameo appearance in Sammo Hung's Pedicab Driver from 1989, a scene that Sammo inserted into his movie simply because he wanted to do a scene with Lau Kar-Wong. And then, of course, in Drunken Master 2, he's a major supporting character. and actually defeats Jackie Chan in combat, which is, I think you can say he's probably the only one to have defeated both Sammo Hung and Jackie Chan in their own movies.
Yeah. Yeah, so go check out, you know, 36 Chamber, 8 Diagram Pole Fighter. Yeah, it's a sad day, or a sad week.
So yeah, and so now, back to Devo.
Welcome back to the George Sanders Show. This segment now is we're calling Cinema Essentials. It's each week we're going to pick a film that kind of best represents some sort of aesthetic or feeling or whatever, anything under the sun, and we'll tell you to go watch it. And if you're smart, you'll listen to us and do it.
And in theory, it would be somewhat related to the movies we're discussing on that week's show.
In theory. And this week, it so happens that that worked out. I was thinking about Drug War, and there's a pivotal scene, and we'll be talking about Drug War in a minute, but there's a pivotal scene where a cop has to ingratiate himself with the criminal underworld, and he ends up having to take a lot of drugs. and so I thought, why not pick the film that is the most intoxicating for us? The film where you had the most surreal experience either watching it or when you came out of the movie, you just felt under the influence of something. And, you know, Sean and I are old and boring now, and we're pretty sober guys, so this is pretty much the only way we can get our kicks. but for me, the thing that first sprung to mind when I thought of most intoxicating film was Terry Gilliam's adaptation of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which I've only actually seen once, partially because of the experience I had. I saw it when it came out in 98 at a little theater in San Mateo, California. And I saw it with some friends, and we were seniors in high school then. And we came out of that thing just completely punch drunk. I mean, I remember we were driving home in, yes, a VW bus. But
of course.
Well, of course, but we were totally sober, had we been pulled over or something. But we were just, I mean, we were high off of that movie. I mean, it's such a surreal experience, and Gilliam really manages to tap into that feeling of being high. And, you know, being high, you see it in so many films and so many different ways, on TV shows and stuff. But there's always this kind of detachment to it, or it's too much or whatever. But for me, the head trip that is that movie it really took me to another place. And I stumbled out of the theater giddy and laughing, like I just smoked a joint.
I do love the book, Fear and Loathing in
Las Vegas. Well, like I said, I haven't seen it since then. I was 17 years old. I'm not saying it's the greatest movie of all time, but that experience to me was magical in its own weird way.
It's a solid adaptation of the book, but you know, that kind of feeling is kind of, it's pre critical. It's not really something you can say, you know, this is a good movie.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Or you know, it's hard to even literally kind of pinpoint those things that kind of trigger that reaction in you. Mm-hmm. Like when you asked me about this, you know, there was a number of films that come to mind, like Busby Berkeley's The Gang's All Here is with Carmen Miranda. It's just kind of weird and mm-hmm. surreal and hallucinatory. Luc Besson's Joan of Arc movie, The Messenger, with Mila Jovovich, which I saw in a sold-out, packed Metro auditorium in 1999. I left the auditorium with exactly that feeling, and I'm not sure if it was just kind of like an oxygen deprivation from being in one of those crowded Metro theaters, or
rat-infested.
The bright colors and the rapid cutting of the Luc Besson movie triggered like an acid flashback.
Mm-hmm.
or if it was like something about the movie itself. I rewatched the movie years later, and it was not particularly good.
See, that's why I'm afraid of going. You know, I'm definitely afraid of going back to Fear and Loathing for that very reason.
But you know, if you want to talk in more general terms about this kind of cinephilic high that you get from watching a really great movie, I get that all the time. And the most reliable source of it to me are my favorite movies, you know, Casablanca, Chungking Express, Annie Hall, Manhattan movies that...
Oh, yeah, that put a spring in your step and you walk out just, you know, exhilarated. I mean, yeah, that's... To me, that's a little different. I mean, I could rattle off, you know, 20 names right now of films that, you know, give me that sense of just wonder and stuff.
But, you know, films that made me feel physically intoxicated.
We're going with The Messenger?
I'm going with The Messenger.
Cool. All right, so that's Cinema Essentials. We'll hopefully do this every week and have some interesting conversations.
We're going to listen to some more Devo right now, and then we'll come back and talk about Johnny Toe's Drug War. All right, we're back, and before we start talking about Drug War, we're going to talk a little bit about Johnny Toe. He is our person of the week, and Hong Kong director. He's roughly contemporary with Choi Hark or John Woo. He started in television in Hong Kong in the 1970s. He directed his first movie in 1980 and kind of went back and forth between film and television throughout that decade. He made his first crime film in 1988, coincidentally enough, called The Big Heat. His most famous of his early films, at least in America, are his collaborations with action director Ching Siu Tung on the Heroic Trio and its sequel, which is a kind of superhero movie starring Michelle Yeoh, Anita Mui, and Maggie Cheung. They're really kind of campy and comic book style, and not really all that similar to the films that Johnny Toe would later on become famous for. In 1997, he formed his own production company, Milky Way Image, and began producing a series of crime movies by other directors, but those directors often didn't work out, and Toe had a strong creative influence on them, and eventually he just began directing his own movies. And for the last 15 years or so, he's managed to put out two or three movies a year, all of very high quality in a variety of genres, but mostly crime dramas and romantic comedies. I'm a huge Johnny Toe fan. I spent most of the first half of this year watching Johnny Toe movies. I watched about 40 or 50 Johnny Toe or Johnny Toe related films this year. If you're new to Johnny Toe, if you're not that familiar with his work, I would recommend his 2006 movie Exiled, which is a hitman movie with a strong spaghetti western influence. His 2008 pickpocket film Sparrow, which is more of a light musical comedy. The movie 1999 Running Out of Time, which is a heist film with Andy Lau and Lau Ching Wan. The election movies, Election 1, Election 2.
It's a lot of movies, Sean.
Are available on Netflix.
I think that's a good place to stop. I mean, I know you could rattle off all, 45 titles or whatever, but no, it's great because, you know, for me, I've heard Johnny Toe's name bandied about so much, often from you, but from other people as well. And it's you know, there are so many films that it's hard to figure out where you should go as an entry point. You know, it's kind of like the works of, you know, Frank Zappa or something, except Frank Zappa sucks.
His most recent film isn't available yet in the U.S. Blind Detective premiered earlier this year at Cannes, I believe it premiered.
Yeah.
But his next most recent film, Drug War, is actually a pretty good starting place. And that is the movie we're going to talk about, and that was your first Johnny Toe film. So that was Drug War, and like I said, Mike, this was your first Johnny Toe film. What did you think?
Well, before I get to that, I think I need to give a little bit of background on how I came into this movie, because admittedly, I'm not an action movie connoisseur or really a fan, and we actually, you and I had a lively debate on Letterboxd about this a few months prior to seeing Drug War, when I finally watched Hard Boiled, John Woo's Hard Boiled, which is, you know, probably the quintessential Hong Kong action movie. And
it's the greatest action movie of all time.
Exactly. And I gave it, you know, I enjoyed it. I didn't love it. And we had this discussion where I just said that I feel like I'm on the outside looking in on action movies. And, you know, you made some very great points. You know, you compared them to musicals and how the artifice is part of the enjoyment and all that stuff. And I, while I did really enjoy the technical elements of Hard Boiled, like, the, I mean, there's that great tracking shot and there's some really wonderful set pieces and stuff, I still just couldn't connect with the material in a way to really put it over the top for me. I respect what it is, but it's really not my kind of thing. And so not only am I not really a Johnny Toe scholar, but going into Drug War, I'm also really, I mean, that whole genre is not really what I go for.
You were expecting a John Woo-style action spectacular.
Yeah, I was a little bit, you know, but to getting to Drug War, it's awesome. I thought it was really great. I was engaged from the opening scene, which just throws you in into this world, and you just gotta, you know, catch up and follow along and stick right with it. And I did, and I had a really great experience with it. And I'm definitely very excited about checking out more Toe stuff down the line. And what I liked about this movie is that I tried not to come in with any expectations, but I did, as you do. But it subverted my expectations almost at every turn. Like, it's ostensibly it's an action film set in the obviously the criminal underworld where drug trafficking is going on, and you know, cops are trying to stop this and stuff. And at least for the first hour or so, there are a number of times where you expect things to blow up into this action extravaganza. There's a moment where a character is under surveillance, or the cops have him arrested, but he's at a hospital because he's been injured, and he finds a moment to slip away, and he's escaping through this hospital, and he ends up hiding out, and the cops are trying to track him down and stuff, and he ends up hiding in the morgue, and the tension is palpable, and you expect this either a shootout, or you expect some crazy escape, or something, or some, you know, someone's gonna die, something crazy is gonna happen. And he ends up just getting caught, and he goes and he's back under police, you know, watch. And throughout the film, there are moments like that where I kept expecting, and 95% of the films would take you to this one place, and this movie didn't. But it didn't subvert your expectations in a calculated way. It seemed very organic. It didn't seem like it was, you know, trying to, you know, take a left turn, it just seemed like, oh yeah, that could happen, you know? So
it's not really an action movie. It's a police procedural, and this kind of, and it's got this suspense structure. Well, it will build up tension and build it up and build it up. And instead of releasing it with a bang, like you get in an action movie or a musical for that matter, it just kind of slowly dissipates that energy until it starts to build up again. And it just keeps kind of snowballing as the film goes along until the climax, which is this kind of big...
where there is a blow-up. I mean, it teases you along and it fizzles out, you know, with these what you expect to be an action moment. But by the last 20 minutes or so, bullets are flying, people are dying. It's, you know, it is pretty... pretty insane there by the end. I mean, there's a lot of blood and, you know, bullets.
Yeah, the films that most reminded me of, like, obviously The Departed and Infernal Affairs, and mm-hmm. kind of shares that same triad gangster world, especially with cops impersonating criminals mm-hmm. and vice versa. And to that extent, it reminded me most of Inglourious Basterds, Quentin Tarantino's film, which is structured as a series of conversations where one person is trying to convince the other person that they are not who they actually are. And that, in a lot of ways, is how Drug War is structured. The Louis Gu is captured and is, in order to avoid the death penalty, he agrees to set up meetings with the cops and the higher-ups in his drug organization. And the cops go through these meetings and they keep climbing higher and higher in the gangster hierarchy, all the while pretending to be people they are really not. And so then that's the kind of the basic structure of Drug War, is a series of performance interviews where being a cop is a performative act, mm-hmm. which is a strong Tarantino theme. Like you see it obviously in Reservoir Dogs, the speech about how the cop's got to be an undercover cop's got to be a great actor.
Mm-hmm.
You see it in Glorious Bastards, you see it in Jackie Brown also.
You see it in Django too, where he has to pretend to be, you know, this Mandingo expert and, you know, infiltrate this plantation and stuff.
Yeah, so I think this is Johnny Toe's most Tarantino-esque movie, and in that way, I think it makes a good introduction for Western audiences who have never really gotten a chance to see Johnny Toe movies before. A few have gotten, you know, somewhat limited theatrical distribution mm-hmm. in the U.S. Election 2 did. But Drug War will be coming out in just a few weeks, and it looks like it'll be given a decent release. So if you've never seen a Johnny Toe movie before, I think now is your chance, and this is a good one to start with.
Yeah, I agree completely, as obviously this was my first film, and I am just dying to see more now. Speaking of performance, the performances are all great, but really the performance of the main cop, what's his character's name?
I don't know if the cop...
Does he have a name?
I think he has a name. He's the cop in my notes. And
okay.
That's one of the interesting things about the movie is that the cops are not differentiated all that much. Mm-hmm. They don't have a backstory. Anything we learn about their character is just entirely through their actions as police officers. There's no kind of exposition about, you know, his ex-wife or his kid at home who's mm-hmm. got leukemia or something. There's none of that. He's just a cop, and he exists only to enforce the laws.
Right. And his performance is really astounding, because in the beginning, you know, he's very, you know, kind of going back to Buster Keaton, stone-faced a little bit, you know, and he's very, you know, subdued, and but then he has this moment, which I mentioned earlier, where he has to, as you said, pretend to be a drug lord, or, you know, someone on this chain of command in the drug world. And he meets this guy that he's going to portray, and he just observes him, and then the next scene is him doing an impersonation of this guy, and then the guy is very bombastic.
His name is Ha-Ha.
His name is Ha-Ha, and so he, which is actually really funny. I mean, he's constantly laughing. He's this kind of explosive powder keg of a character, and on a dime, this guy just completely, you know, turns into this character, and for the first 45 minutes or however long it is, I would not have been able to expect that he could have pulled it off, but he really sold this this character, and he ends up having to, as we said earlier, take drugs to prove himself, and he, you know, he's so dedicated to his job and his pursuit of justice and stuff that he's willing to take these high powered, you know, drugs that he's not very, you know, I mean, obviously he doesn't take them, and put himself in mortal danger to convince these guys that he's one of them. And he just does a phenomenal job.
Yeah, the actor who plays the cop is terrific. He's Soon Hong Lei, who I've seen before in a couple of movies, but some very old movies. A movie called Zhou Yu's Train, Zhang Yimou's The Road Home. He also starred in Zhang Yimou's remake of the Coen Brothers' Blood Simple, A Woman, a Gun, and a Noodle Shop.
Did you see that, by the
way? I did not see that.
It's not very good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is kind of the first time I've really... he's also in Triangle, which is an omnibus film that John Ito directed a third of, along with Ringo Lam and Choi Hark, two other great Hong Kong directors. But this is the first time I ever really noticed him as an actor, and he's terrific. Louis Gu, who plays Timmy, the drug dealer who's on the run and caught by the cops, he stars in a number of John Ito films in all kinds of different roles. He's terrific in romantic comedies like the other film that John Ito did in 2012, Romancing in Thin Air, and also the previous year's Don't Go Breaking My Heart. Both are very good romantic comedies. He stars in John Ito's judo movie Throwdown, which might be his best performance in a John Ito film, and is also one of the oddest of all John Ito movies. I really like it a lot. But I think he's really terrific in Drug War as well. He's just kind of this panicky, weaselly kind of guy.
Well, and you can't really get a read on him, too, because he, for a while, you know, he totally sells out to the cops, and you kind of start to believe him that he's really going to be working with them, and he's you know, obviously he's doing it to save his own skin or whatever. But then he has this reversal at the end, which leads to this giant shootout where he snitches on the cops, and all these drug lords now know that, you know, that they're being followed, and you know, and it leads to this explosive finale. And he does a really good job of playing it close to the vest throughout the movie, where you don't really know where his allegiances are. I mean, he obviously doesn't have really allegiances. He's just looking out for number one, which is shown explicitly at the very end of the film, where he's pretty much the last man standing with a cop handcuffed to his ankle.
This is John Ito's first crime movie in mainland China, and there's been some discussion over how pro-Chinese it is. Like, is it propaganda for the Chinese state? Do you think it's kind of slightly subversive of the Chinese government? Any opinions on that?
I didn't get the sense. Usually I can kind of, I mean, I like to think that I can kind of tell when I'm being spoon-fed something, or if there's like some sort of agenda that's being pushed my way, and if there is one with Drug War, it's subtle, or it's not overwhelming. I mean, yeah, the cops they win the day and stuff, but you know, a lot of bad shit goes down before that happens, and I don't think I wouldn't call it propaganda.
No, I wouldn't either. It seems much darker to me than that, especially in its in this depiction of the death penalty for drug dealers. Like, it's not a heroic act for the government to execute the criminals. Like, it's shown in painful detail, and it's very much the effect, at least on me, is very anti-death penalty. It's like we should not be doing that to individuals, which I don't think is something that the Chinese government would be particularly fond of a filmmaker proposing.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a horrific end to the film, and tying it in with the whole drug war in the title. I mean, yeah, it's, you know, you could even argue that it's anti-government in a way, because it's showing that, hey, they're using drugs to achieve their ends.
I also think that the impersonality of the cops sends kind of a subtle anti-governmental message. It's much like a Fritz Lang machine. These cops are just instruments of the state. They have no personalities of their own. They're just out there to punish these criminals. And, you know, that's one of the reasons I proposed The Big Heat as the movie we were going to pair with Drug War, is I think they both create similarly kind of paranoid machine-like worlds where there's not a whole lot of agency that the individual's characters have. That kind of, once the plot begins, everything kind of follows from that, and there's not a whole lot of air
mm-hmm.
for the people
mm-hmm.
in either of these movies.
Mm-hmm. I would also just like to point out that we've mentioned the main actors in the film, but there's also some really great secondary characters that. There are these two brothers that are deaf, and they're working, you know, they're low level grunts at for these drug manufacturers and stuff, and they could have just been quirky, you know, oh, they're deaf, you know, that's their quirk or whatever, that, you know, whatever, but that disability is actually used for a really great set piece later in the film, when the cops raid the warehouse where they're working, and it gives this what could be a cliche, or, you know, just another run of the mill run on a place. It gives it this new dimension, because they're experiencing it differently, because they can't hear the gunfire. You know, one of them is in the other room; he's using the bathroom or something, and he doesn't know that. there's this squadron of police shooting the place up, and he's just reading his magazine on the toilet, you know. And it's a really, you know, this quirk, or this, you know, this thing that defines them could have just been that. It could have been just thrown out there, just to throw out there. But Toe actually uses that to create a really interesting and original scene, or a couple of scenes, actually, in the movie.
Yeah, disabled characters or characters with some kind of physical infirmity are a recurring feature of Johnny To films. Something he inherited, I think, from Chang Che, who directed The One-Armed Swordsman, and also the great kung fu film Crippled Avengers.
Mm-hmm. Well, and his new one, To's new one is The Blind Detective. So.
Right, he's had blind characters, he's had... crazy characters, 2007 film Mad Detective.
Mm-hmm.
So
let me ask you this then, as a novice then, does he do similar things where he, I mean, obviously I assume he would, where he kind of crafts these set pieces around those disabilities?
Yeah, it's generally kind of the disability is often like a motivator for the plot, like a character is going blind, but you don't realize that until, you know, 20 minutes are left in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But suddenly when you realize that the character is going blind, it explains all of his odd behavior and
mm-hmm.
actions throughout the rest of the film.
Oh, great. So now I'm going to watch every Johnny To movie and assume every character is blind at the outset, or going blind at the outset.
Yeah, I'm not going to tell you which one it is.
Oh, great.
But, you know, it's a great movie.
I'm sure not.
in Mad Detective, the character is... The mad detective is crazy and can, like, imagine himself in crimes and thinks he's psychic and sees ghosts. And so it's just kind of the conceit of the plot. And also in My Left Eye Sees Ghosts, Sammy Chang's character sees ghosts through her left eye.
I wouldn't call that a disability. I'd call that an upgrade.
it causes her more problems than
okay.
Than perhaps it would be worth.
Sure.
So yeah, I mean he's very creative with his use of disabilities and how they relate to plot and character.
Interesting. So yeah, so that's Drug War. I heartily recommend it. I think it's a really fantastic film. And like I said, I look forward to seeing more of Toh's work in the ensuing months, and maybe I'll talk about those as I get to them on the show.
Yeah, it's terrific. It's coming out at the end of July or August at an art house theater near you, and then should probably be available on, you know, streaming and internet. It's also out there in an illegal internet copy right now.
But go to a theater and see it. It's yeah. It's a good cinema going experience.
Absolutely.
Support your local cinema before it disappears. Before it disappears.
And that is it for the inaugural episode of the George Sanders Show.
I wonder how many people made it this far.
All of them.
Oh, I would like to say hi, Jeff, because our good friend Jeff, who also used to work at the Metro with us, he did promise us that he would listen to at least one episode of this, and I'm assuming this was the one. So, Jeff, if you're still listening, thanks, buddy, and you don't have to listen any further.
So next week on the show, in honor, more or less, of Gore Verbinski's The Lone Ranger, we're going to be talking about two westerns. The first is a Johnny Depp western when he was actually good, Jim Jarmusch's Dead Man. And the second is Bud Bedeker's Randolph Scott western, Ride Lonesome.
Yeah, so we're tying it in. We got the Johnny Depp, so I think we nailed that one.
Yeah, I think we got it covered.
It's going to be great. In between, you can find us online at the georgesandersshow.blogspot.com or on the Twitter at the Geo Sanders Show.
It's just Geo Sanders.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Well, what the hell? Just Geo Sanders?
Geo Sanders Show.
Show. Geo Sanders. See, I don't know this Twitter stuff. I'm an old man. More of Sean's writing can be laughed at the end of cinema.blogspot.com, while my purple prose overfloweth at the utterpiffle.blogspot.com. Both Sean and I are on Letterboxd under those respective handles, The End of Cinema and Utter Piffle.
And yeah, you can also follow me personally on Twitter at The End of Cinema.
There you go. I'm not on the Twitter, but maybe I'll tweet under our moniker of the Geo Sanders. Wait, just Geo Sanders?
The Geo Sanders Show.
Maybe I won't, because I won't figure out how to do it. If you're in the Palo Alto, California vicinity this coming week, I recommend going to the Majestic Stanford Theater and seeing the Astaire Rogers double feature of The Gay Divorcee and Top Hat, which is running June 29th through July 2nd.
That's a great pair of movies there.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome.
If you're in the New York area, you've got to go to the New York Asian Film Festival, where you can see, among many other great-looking movies, Johnny Toh's Drug War.
And if you're not in New York or Palo Alto, just stay at home, listen to Devo, and watch Kung Fu movies.
Sounds good to me. That's what I'll be doing.
See you next week.
Just a kiss, a sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by. And when two lovers woo, they still say I love you. On that you can rely. No matter what the future brings, as time goes by. Moonlight and love songs, never out of date. Hearts full of passion, jealousy and hate. Woman needs man, and man must have his mate, that no one can deny. It's still the same old story, a fight for love and glory, a case of do or die. The world will always welcome lovers as time.